From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and events from the Central and South America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Okay, so let's start in Colombia with what happened over the weekend and what that might all mean.
As expected, the Duque, the right-wing presidential candidate in Colombia's election, won by a big margin. On a very low turnout, it has to be said. And I haven't seen the latest figures for the election results in Colombia's presidential election yesterday, but the results that I did see put the turnout at just over 44%. And that's quite ironic because the Colombian political leaders made great show of the fact that Venezuela's turnout in its presidential election just a couple of weeks ago, two or three weeks ago, was around 47%. And they said, well, that just shows how little legitimacy Nicolas Maduro has as president of Venezuela. So now Duque's been elected as the president of Colombia on a percentage of only 44%. But right. You won't hear him saying, you won't hear him questioning his own legitimacy, of course.
Right.
So what's the regional significance of that? Well, none of it is good, because looked at from a point of view of Nicaragua, Juan Manuel Santos, the current Colombian president, has been dragging his feet in his obligation to recognize the International Court of Justice decision to reinstate 90,000 square kilometers of maritime territory that Colombia had usurped for around 80, 90 years. And that decision was given back in 2013, I think. And although in practice the Colombian Navy seems to be respecting that decision, Juan Manuel Santos and the Colombian government have never recognized it. So from Nicaragua's point of view, and Alvaro Uribe, the extreme right-wing narco-terrorist ex-president, is the person who is regarded as the power behind the throne, as it were, for Duque, the new president.
Right.
So
That's where I wanted to go for a second, because this was the second round. They had the first round was last month, and you had Duque and Petro, the top two vote getters at that time, and with pretty small pieces of the vote, by the way. Want to talk about margins. It was 13% turnout, I think, in the first round. It was 53% turnout in the first round, and he got 13% of that. That was Duque, the winner. And the second place person got like 33, a third of a percent, I think, or something, like a really low number. And then, so you have Duque representing more or less, I mean, you've got the FARC people and then the soft left, and then Santos and then Uribe at the hard right. And so Duque is more or less representing the Uribe trend in the politics?
Yeah, absolutely. The extreme right wing. And to the right of Juan Manuel Santos.
Okay? Right, okay. And then Petro sort of representing Juan Manuel Santos trend. Is that kind of true?
Yeah, and basically Duque is a representative of Uribe's paramilitary base, and that's the political base of Alvaro Uribe, and the paramilitaries. And I think we've said this before. Colombia has something like 1,200 municipalities, and the paramilitaries control around 250 of those, something like that. And so, in any election, any election, the extreme right wing already have a built-in advantage because their paramilitaries intimidate people into voting for the candidate for Uribe's candidate.
Or into not voting in those areas, because we're looking again, you're talking about turnout. The population in 2016 of Colombia was just shy of 50 million, like 48.65 million
right.
or something.
Right.
The total turnout yesterday was shy of 20 million. And Duque, the winner, had 10,373,000 votes on, you know, out of almost 50 million. So, right. you know, that's like 5%. Some mandate.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the percentage of the electorate is.
Well, 5% of the population, so figure maybe that's 10% of the electorate. If half the people are not eligible to vote, then there should have been 25 million people voting yesterday, and he got 10 million votes. That's not even half.
Right, I think the Colombian electorate is around 30 million, the people okay. entitled to vote.
Okay.
So, as I say, I haven't seen the final figure, but the figures that for participation that I did see put the turnout of, at around 44% of eligible voters. Anyway, I'm when we talk about these elections, it's easy to fall into the trap of treating them as though they are somehow democratic. But and of course, right. There are all kinds of factors that militate against any free and fair elections in Colombia or anywhere else, really, but particularly in Colombia. Even taking that system, let's pretend it's democratic for a minute. And what happened in the first round was that Petro got something like 26-27% of the vote, but surprisingly, another social democrat style candidate, Sergio Fajardo's, more centre right perhaps than Gustavo Petro, he got 20%. Now, and everybody thought immediately after that first round that Sergio Fajardo would validate Gustavo Petro, but instead of doing that, he said he'd abstained.
Wow.
He told his people to abstain.
Mm.
So mm-hmm. now if you look at that, that's just one yet another example of a social democrat style politician holding the door open for the right.
Right.
You know? And, yep. and so if they'd combined, if Sergio Fajardo and Petro had combined, they'd have wiped out Duque.
Mm.
Because their combined vote would have been between 45-50% of the vote,
right.
without taking into account the independents.
You
know, so they would have won hands down if Fajardo and Petro had united. But anyway, and that's what happened. So I'm going back to the consequences for the consequences internally for Colombia are not good, because
yeah.
Duque represents the most recalcitrant reactionary elements in Colombia's oligarchic elite.
Well, I'm thinking about his relationship to Uribe, at least ideologically, and what that means for the peace, the situation.
Yeah, I know. You can probably kiss goodbye to a satisfactory outcome for the peace protest, because I'm Duque. Although in the campaign he made nicey-nice and said that he wanted to reform the peace process, and that's not true. He and Uribe want to kill it. You know, they want to lock up all the FARC members that negotiated in good faith.
Right, who got disarmed, by the way.
Yeah, so, you know, and they disarmed in good faith. Juan Manuel Santos and the Colombian state failed to comply with their side of the agreement, foot-dragging on almost every point. And engaging in judicial harassment of FARC leaders, failing to comply with the rural provisions for agricultural reform that would have benefited all rural families in Colombia, not just the members of the FARC. But I know a whole series of agreements that they've reneged on, in effect, and although they would say that they couldn't overcome the institutional obstacles in Colombia's system, but you know the legislature, the judiciary. But if there'd been the political will, they could have implemented the agreement. But there was never the political will, and all of us who were sceptical to begin with and fearful to begin with, in that regard, have been proved right.
Yeah.
I know I'm not happy to say that.
Yeah.
But and the so that and internally in, and even economically, and that's bad news for people in Colombia, because Duque is just going to deepen the ridiculous neoliberal system that has impoverished so many people in Colombia. I don't know the exact figures, but the poverty figures for Colombia are extremely high, in, even right. in terms of region.
Right.
And Colombia is the most unequal country in a very unequal continent.
Right.
So, and domestically, it's all bad news. And on the foreign affairs front, as I was saying, from Nicaragua's point of view, it's bad news because Duque will probably be more aggressive about failing to implement the International Court of Justice decision. So they'll probably be more conflict on that front. But more importantly for the region, it's very bad news for Venezuela, because Venezuela is now faced with a president in Colombia who's totally committed to implementing U.S. policy, the most aggressive U.S. policy in the region against Venezuela.
Right.
It's also very... So will that mean some kind of military intervention along the Venezuelan-Colombian border? It might well do. We'll see. You never know when extreme right-wingers are voted into power, because sometimes they moderate their rhetoric once they get into office. But I fear that's not going to be the case with Duque, because he's such a creature of Alvaro Uribe.
Right.
We'll see. And then in broader regional terms, the election of Duque also very badly threatens the integration processes. For example, the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR, and the group of Latin American and Caribbean states, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, CELAC. And it will most of the right wing elites in Latin America support CELAC because it's a good forum for negotiating directly with China and other world players like the Russian Federation and the European Union. For example, the European Union and CELAC have been holding, I'm not sure if they're annual or biannual, conferences. And that's very useful from the point of view of the Latin American elites, because that gives them a better forum to negotiate from than bilateral agreements with individual countries. But and certainly in terms of UNASUR, and it's not good news for UNASUR, because Colombia is one of the countries that said it would withdraw from UNASUR a couple of months ago. So Duque is likely to implement that seriously. You know, it's just bad news all around for any progressive agenda in the region.
Yeah, and also, right, for the region. I mean, one of the things, just looking at a map, one of the things that you notice, in big letters, Colombia is the contact point between Central America and South America. So it's in terms of physical integration, in terms of movement of goods and people and services back and forth, it mediates it physically.
Yeah.
You know,
And the Colombian business interests have been expanding their investments in Central America, and they got a very helpful bridgehead in Honduras as a result of the 2009 coup against President Mel Zelaya.
Right.
And they along with Israel gave very substantial security support to the coup regime in 2009. Mm. And from Honduras, and they've also been expanding into Guatemala. I don't know about El Salvador, but they've definitely been expanding into Nicaragua, and that's one of the kind of contradictions for the right wing here in Nicaragua. The right wing business interests are against Daniel Ortega. They want to overthrow the government of President Ortega. But they're concerned that the much wealthier Colombian business interests are going to displace them in that process. Maybe we can talk a bit more about that if we have time to talk about Nicaragua. The thing about Colombia is that its economy has shifted more and more away from the kind of productive economy that promotes genuine economic prosperity to the kind of financialized economy that you have in the United States, where and all that generates is a tendency to increasing poverty and a definite tendency towards increasing inequality.
Right.
So that's what's happening in Colombia, and you know, and that was reflected in the turnout. The very low turnout reflects the fact that the impoverished majority see no point in trying to engage in electoral politics because it's never done them any good, and their interests are always shoved to the margins.
Yeah, the only thing that changes after, you know, going out and busting your behind all day is the numbers on somebody's ledger, as opposed to, well, we produced 18 more mangoes and a Buick or whatever. There's no actual physical activity going on in the economy. It's all financialized nonsense.
Yeah, and you can see that in Argentina. And we right from the start, when Mauricio Macri's right-wing government was elected back in November 2015, you and I have been insisting that sooner rather than later, the Argentinian economy is going to implode because the neoliberal model that Macri and his team want to impose benefit mainly foreign investors and foreign finance interests and do not do anything for Argentine's real productive economy.
Right.
And that's exactly what's happened. Macri, after a year of somewhat incoherent economic policy, made it very clear that he was banking on foreign investment to reactivate Argentina's productive economy. That didn't happen, and as a result, obviously, he had to resort to debt.
Right.
Now he's resorted to substantial foreign debt. The dollar's taken off in terms of its value against the Argentine peso in Argentina. Now the productive economy that works in pesos can't generate enough money to pay the foreign debt denominated in dollars. So as a result, there's a balance of payments crisis. What happens in a balance of payments crisis? The government goes running to the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. Right. The International Monetary Fund imposes absurd austerity measures, and that's exactly what's happening in Argentina.
Yep.
So the IMF is now effectively in charge of Argentina's economic policy.
I mean, what ends up happening again is an incremental conveyance of the title to the productive economy to finance sector. That's what happens, and all the rest of it is, you know, is circus. But what ends up happening is you have these two different financial regimes, two different currency regimes or whatever. One sets the rules for both. The crisis is created in the process, and the solution is imposed by the one that precipitated the crisis or imposed the crisis in the first place. Well, who ends up representing the beneficiaries of the transfer of wealth of the subject nation state or other entity?
Yeah, and the one of the few economists worth reading is Michael Hudson, very experienced, well-known U.S. economist.
Yep.
And he writes about what he calls the toll booth economy.
Yep.
You know, everything, you know, even fresh air eventually, and gets some financialized so that ordinary people have to pay the banks.
Right.
For what should be basic rights, you know, right. Whether it's from whether it's public roads, public education, the health system, everything gets financialized, and that's you can see that whole process is happening in Argentina.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so, they did it once before, and we saw where it led.
Yeah,
I mean, they actually did it several times before, and each time it led that way, and that's what we said was going to happen when Macri got elected back in December. Or was it 2015 or whatever? And sure as hell, here we are.
Yeah, and you don't need to be clear. You know, we're not clairvoyants.
Right, exactly.
It's just two and two equals four, you know?
Here comes a bus. It's storming down the road. I'm going to step into the lane at the last minute. Gee, I wonder what will happen. Do I need a crystal ball?
Right. So, What else has been going on, Nine? Well, more on a more positive note, in Bolivia, Evo Morales will very shortly be making a visit to China, which is of great significance for the Andean region, because Bolivia is the most successful economy in terms of many indicators. And if Evo Morales and his government can consolidate an even more successful relationship with China than they already have, that would be very good news for the overall region, for the Andean economy.
Yep.
And that's reflected, you know, you'd expect the right-wing governments of Peru, the right-wing government, or the center-right government that has now taken hold in Ecuador under Lenin Moreno, the right-wing government under Chile, the right-wing government in Paraguay, the right-wing usurper government under Michel Temer in Brazil. You'd expect them all to be quite hostile to Bolivia, but they're not.
Right.
At least not on the surface.
Right.
And they recently had, I think, what was it, the 23rd, or I've forgotten the number now, but they recently had the South American Games, the kind of a subset of the Olympic Games for South America.
Right.
And that went off very, very successfully in Bolivia, and a very successful event in terms of public relations for the Bolivian government within the region.
Mm.
And much more importantly, Bolivia recently had a meeting, I think it was Peru, Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay took part in a meeting with Bolivia about the Chinese-funded transcontinental railway, which is projected to cost about $10 billion, and maybe, if not more, and it's always, all these estimates turn out being underestimates, don't they?
Of course.
For these massive mega projects. So that's a transcontinental railway running from the port of Ilo on the southern Pacific coast of Peru, running through Bolivia, Paraguay, into Brazil, and reaching the Atlantic at the Brazilian port of Santos, which is just north of Uruguay. So Uruguay, Brazil, Paraguay, and Peru met with Bolivia recently, agreed various details that needed to be settled before the project could go ahead. All those details seem to have been agreed without difficulty. So that project is, it looks as though it's going to go ahead. And that's very, very positive for South America.
Yeah. Yeah, transcontinental railroad. It'll do wonders. Ask the people of California.
Right.
Yeah.
So then, I, by contrast, here in Nicaragua, it's very clear that one of the reasons that the United States government and the United States elites, represented by various interests, they're continuing with their efforts to overthrow the government of the Sandinista government of President Ortega. And I wrote a piece about this today that's out on Telesur, in which I explain, or I argue, that what's happening here in Nicaragua is just the latest phase of a long permanent war by the United States against any progressive force that raises its head above the parapet here in Latin America and the Caribbean.
Wow.
And so, and it's very much part of the decades-long ongoing war against Cuba, the continuing campaign against the government of the Bolivarian government, currently of Nicolas Maduro, but previously of President Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And eventually they'll get to work trying to destabilize in a more aggressive way the government of Evo Morales in Bolivia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's behind the overthrow of Dilma Rousseff and the imprisonment of Lula da Silva in Brazil.
Right.
And so, and that's what the crisis in Nicaragua is all about. And if you look at what's happening here, it's very clear that the United States has learned from its experience supporting fascist movements elsewhere in the world, and terrorist movements elsewhere in the world, for example, especially in the Ukraine, but also in Libya and more recently Syria. And they support terrorism to intimidate the population, to make it harder for the legitimate government to consolidate coherent support around its political program. And then when their terrorist elements manage to force the government into any kind of negotiation, they apply the same process that they've used in the Minsk agreement in Ukraine, whereby they'll kind of reach an agreement. But they'll fail to implement the agreement. They'll systematically fail to implement the agreement.
That's right.
But in the process, for every failure of the agreement, they'll blame the other side that's actually behaving in good faith.
Right.
And that is what is happening here in Nicaragua now. Because if you remember in our previous conversations, I described how there's a national dialogue process happening here in Nicaragua,
right,
supposedly mediated by the Nicaraguan bishops. Mm. Now, that's been a stop-start process. The bishops suspended it about 2.5-3 weeks ago because the government wouldn't agree to the way the bishops were handling it. Mm. And now it restarted again last Friday, but the bishops haven't changed at all, despite the presence of a new papal nuncio sent by Pope Francis, presumably specifically to try and get the bishops here to behave. But, well, he's not having much success.
I mean, what we're talking about, just for people to understand, the bishops in Nicaragua are siding with the right-wing violence, essentially, and the calling on people. They basically were calling on the government to surrender the streets to right-wing gangs. The Pope is saying, no, if you're going to be involved, be an honest broker and call for peace on all sides. And they're not doing that. They're very partisan.
They're still supporting the right-wing. And
right.
So, for example, on Friday night, there was, after very, very bitter negotiations, the right wing finally agreed to dismantle the roadblocks that are paralyzing the country's economy and have done so for the last 5 or 6 weeks now, if not for 2 months. But suddenly the roadblocks have really paralyzed the economy. And one has to remember that all this activity is happening in about 30 municipalities in Nicaragua, mainly along the Pacific coast. So, and Nicaragua has 153 municipalities, so you're talking about something like a fifth of the country. But it's a fifth of the country where most of the population lives. And that's right. Why the opposition are focusing on that part of the country.
Right.
But in effect, the opposition terrorist roadblocks, their paramilitary roadblocks, because they're not manned by students. Overseas people probably think, oh, well, the students and the ordinary population are protesting against the government. Well,
this is a strategic, surgical operation. This is professional. This is the kind of stuff they design in Langley and Pentagon.
Yeah, Don. I mean, it's very well organized. I mean, it's an alliance between organized crime, the Catholic Church hierarchy, and that may sound ridiculous.
Yeah, it's redundant.
On the barricades, on the roadblocks, there's video after video showing priests and pickup trucks flying the yellow and white Catholic Church flag, delivering supplies to armed delinquents, masked delinquents, who are the people that intimidate anybody trying to get through the roadblocks, often charging them money for the right to pass. So when I say it's an alliance between organized crime, delinquents, and the Catholic Church, and that's no exaggeration. It merely reflects the reality, and also, of course, the right wing opposition here, and the most right wing parts of the business sector, they're all part of this conspiracy backed by the most extreme right wing elements in the United States, like Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Ileana Rose Letterman, and that kind of pro-terrorist, anti-Cuban mafia that they represent. Now, there was an interesting recent development that reflected something that also happened in Venezuela when Bob Corker, who I think is the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Yes, he is, yeah.
He visited Nicaragua and had a meeting, I think. I'm not sure if he met with Daniel Ortega, but he certainly met with senior officials from the Nicaraguan government.
Right.
That opens up another channel of communication for the Nicaraguan government with the U.S. power elite establishment.
Yep, and we're going to have to see where that goes. Maybe pick it up here next week because we're out of time. Tony, thank you very much, and we'll be speaking with you again.
Okay, thanks a million, Don.
Thank you.
Take care. Have a good week.
You too. Thanks.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio,
I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.